Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Call this a free question month because today's open season on any medical questions you might have. I have some ideas about what we might get started talking about, and that is, in fact, the wonderful world of CRISPR. I actually have been very, very fascinated with gene editing and this, well, effectively a tool that was created in 2013 or discovered or retooled, whatever word you want to use, by a woman, Jennifer Doudna, who was up at our own Berkeley. And she and another woman did amazing science and managed to create something just like a word processor, but for genetics. And the key with genetic therapy is targeting, being able to target something so you hit the spot that you're trying to hit, has been extraordinarily difficult until CRISPR came along. CRISPR was, in fact, so powerful that everybody who's involved in molecular biology took a look at it and said, you know, we really need to have a kind of Geneva Convention about not doing this science on humans right away. We need to know more. We need to be sure that it's more accurate. We need to be sure we aren't going to have a lot of messed up babies before we start doing this where it really matters. You don't so much care about the goats, but you sure do care about humans. Well, on the eve of an international gene editing summit in Hong Kong this week that was going to be basically all of the people who had agreed to play nice and not play God, a 34-year-old upstart scientist stunned the world. He went on YouTube and announced in several videos that he, Hei Jianqi, had in fact used CRISPR to edit the DNA of two twin girls that were born earlier this month in China. Healthy twin girls. And we don't really know much about it because he hasn't published anything. In fact, he's been doing this work secretly and not sharing his techniques for a couple of years because he wanted to be the guy to get there first. He didn't publish most of his early work. By the way, he got his graduate education in the United States, Rice University in 2010, then a year as a postdoc research fellow at Stanford. And then in 2012, he went back to China because, as he put it, he believed that gene editing of human embryos resulting in live births was legal in China because, hey, there's no law against it. And I guess that's how he wanted to roll. There's no law against it. He's going to do it. Now, in 2016, he decided to exploit, and I'm sorry, I'm going to be a little judgmental here because this guy is a loose cannon and he shouldn't have done this. He reached out to an AIDS advocacy group in Beijing to help him recruit potential study participants because people in China have difficulty getting reproductive technology applied to them where one of the people is HIV positive. Now, there's already ways to protect against the transmission of the virus in IVF, but what this guy wanted to do was pretend to be helping out people with HIV and instead make use of their sperm and eggs for his own purposes, which was to map the genome, no, but to manipulate the genes of the embryo. The patient consent forms, well, the parents were not told what this was about. It was referred to as AIDS vaccine development. Now, for those of you who don't know, there is a protein on the surface of your CD4 cells. Those are the cells that get damaged by the HIV virus. And if you don't have this protein on the surface of your cells, you are automatically immune to AIDS. You might you might test positive, but you will never get the disease because your cells cannot be infected and cannot be damaged by the virus in the same way that other people's. It's really interesting. But all you have to do with CRISPR is put in a sequence of about 20 base pairs long, and just like giving a bloodhound a scented handkerchief and saying, go find this person, which way did they go? Like an old Western or something. This CRISPR technology will go in and it will find that piece of DNA, and it will cut right there, right where you tell it to, and remove the DNA that codes for that receptor on the CD4's lymphocyte. So you've done it. You've made that child, well, essentially, unable to get HIV, unable to get AIDS, rather. They can get the virus, but the virus can't do anything to them because it can't get in to the place where it normally destroys. Now, it's amazing that they could do this. It's also extremely scary. I will be posting on my Ask Dr. Dawn website a link to an art piece that's currently on display. In fact, you can go see it tomorrow at the Tannery in Studio 120. They're having their Christmas market, and it'll be up for your inspection. It's called CRISPR Critters, and it's about where this goes if we let marketing people and industry and corporations get a hold of the ability to make designer babies. We will, in fact, make designer babies, and we will sell the technology to create designer babies, and in a generation, we'll have, well, basically, we'll have something like the plot of Gattaca, a very good science fiction movie if you haven't seen it, where you have genetic haves and genetic have-nots. And it obviously creates, well, what we call in biology speciation. I will also say something even scary about CRISPR is that you can make these changes breed true. You aren't just taking out something for this child. You're taking it out for the entire lineage of all of the descendants of this person. And I don't think we know anywhere near, just for practical stuff, folks, we do not know enough about what these genes do and how they work and what they are and how they interact with each other. We don't know enough to go editing this stuff, particularly, you know, maybe fixing a gene. Well, you could make the argument for that, but only under very controlled circumstances, and certainly not quote-unquote improving or augmenting genes that we aren't really sure we understand, which is most of them, in my opinion. So, very irresponsible, kind of a mad scientist thing. Hard to know where this is going to go, but I want to see this guy do time. I actually wouldn't mind if he got executed, and that's very rare for me to say, but this was so completely wrong to do, just so he could be first. Pure ego and pure money, of course, but this was a sin, and I don't use that word lightly, a sin against humanity, and we may be picking up the pieces for a very, very long time, because this technology is relatively easy to implement. Most graduate molecular biology students could do it. And that's a little bit scary. Well, lately I've been spending quite a bit of time working on my French. And that part of that involves reading the Le Monde online, the newspaper. This was brought to my attention, actually, in the French language literature. And it's important because this is happening all over the planet at the same time, in somewhat different ways. But people have woken up to the fact that medical device manufacturers have been woefully remiss in reporting complications of their devices. There has been the structures that exist for tracing these things are abysmal. Nobody has been paying attention at the level of government regulators. In fact, in many countries in Europe, there really isn't a designated entity to monitor medical devices. In this country, medical devices, if you're a regular listener, you've heard me rant about this before, medical devices are incredibly lax, incredibly loose. And this has to do with implant safety. And we could be talking about artificial hips. We could be talking about breast implants. And I was alluding to the fact that there's a huge international movement to tighten this up so that we can really track these things. One of the things that is really ironic is that the implants themselves don't have a barcode on them. So they can't be, when they're removed, let's say there's a complication or someone dies and you take the implant out, you really don't know what company made it. You don't know what model number it was. And so we can't really do the level of diligence we should be doing to make sure that devices that are inferior, that have more complications, are identified and taken off the market. We also can't really have any idea of exactly how many problems there are. In fact, something really weird happened in the FDA. Between 2008 and 2015, they received about 200 reports of breast implant problems a year. That's tiny given the hundreds of thousands of surgeries. Then last fall, thousands of problems with breast implants started. In the last half of 2017, there were 4,000 reports in just half a year. And the first 6 months of 2018, 8,000 reports. And it turns out that there's a rare type of cancer that was identified in 2011 that is linked to breast implants. I hadn't heard anything about this. This data is really not being shared. This last August, the FDA began allowing 90% of all medical devices, that's heart valves, artificial hips, insulin pumps, to report malfunctions in a quarterly tally instead of individual cases. They won't have to report anything except deaths with specifics. Summary reporting is a bad idea, but, well, you know, it's just another thing brought to you by the current government, is that the safeguards are actually being loosened. There is a database that actually exists that everyone is supposed to report any serious injury, death, or malfunction. It's called Manufacturer and User Facility Device Experience, short MAUD for short. The problem is no one's filling out the forms. There's no common terminology. So if you want to talk about look up Medtronix, there are 1,000 different versions of Medtronic PLC. The thing doesn't do a Boolean search, like a loose search the way your Google browser does. So you won't even be able to find this. But we need to tighten up this process worldwide. This is ridiculous. And these companies have been able to hoodwink us that their devices are safer than they probably are. I want to know what the denominator is, and I want to know what the complication rate and the failure rate is of these things. I don't want it to get so bad that finally the FDA is forced to pull it. I want them to be able to monitor it ahead of time. If you get an implant, if of any kind, it's up to you. You got to do this. You've got to get the make, the model number, the stock number, all of that stuff from the doctor at the time of the procedure, because they're going to throw away the box and it isn't recorded in your medical record. So what if there's a withdrawal? We had a drug withdrawal. Losartan with hydrochlorothiazide, 25 milligram dose, was contaminated with a carcinogen this month. And they were able to alert people and pull it because drugs have lot numbers and barcodes. And we can know exactly where that, unlike romaine lettuce, we can know exactly where those drugs went, what pharmacies have them. They can pull them off the shelves and we can fix the problem. We can't do that with any implantable devices because they aren't set up to do it, and it's just ridiculous. We are going to Gloria in Santa Cruz. Hello, Gloria.
Hi there, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
Hi, I saw your comments in the recent Good Times. This was the November 21st Good Times.
Uh-huh.
Concerning the air from the fires.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, and you mentioned that the particles are inflammatory, they are carcinogenic, they remain in the lungs, and so on and so forth. Okay, well, I have looked into this thing before, in fact, last year, concerning the wine country fires, and I learned the health risks from e-waste, you know, computers, cell phones, TVs, all of that electronic stuff, and that there are a number of elements. If I'd like to read a few of them.
Well, go ahead.
There's lead, there's PVC, there's brominated flame retardants,
mm-hmm.
barium, chromium, mercury, beryllium,
yes.
Yes, and cadmium.
Right.
And so I haven't found this addressed in anything that I've read so far. And, you know, they refer to it as dangerous and carcinogenic and all of the other stuff. But I wonder if you could let us know what you know about this. And you did mention some ways that we might protect ourselves. But and I know that the stuff, like now it's raining and they're saying, oh, well, you know, it's all over. Well, no, it goes into the ground, into the water, into our food supply.
Right. It comes out of the air and onto the dirt. And unfortunately, dirt gets tracked into the house. So that's,
yes.
And that's not going to go away. And this, I want you to go back to 2001, to September 11th, and think about all of the
yes.
computers and wiring and plastic and flame retardant and all of the stuff that was reduced effectively to powder and then distributed over that part of Manhattan, but particularly the people, the first responders and the people who went into that site in the initial days and weeks. If you look now, the death rate in that group from cancer, particularly leukemia, the rates of diabetes, the rates of dementia, just everything that can go wrong with the human as you age, they are so much higher in that group. I remember a figure of 20-fold, but I may not be misremembering that. So, but just statistically outrageous damage. And those people were breathing that for days. And, of course, you wonder whether it's healthy to even live anywhere near that site. But the fact is that we're turning our entire atmosphere with these fires here in California. We're turning our entire atmosphere, and it's into a toxic waste site. And I'm very concerned about what this will do to our health. There are some specific things. You mentioned heavy metals like lead and cadmium. Your body is capable of getting rid of these. So there are things that we suggest under normal circumstances in functional medicine that isn't really known in conventional medicine. So, for example, seaweed, all of the seaweeds, but particularly the red algae seaweeds, are excellent binders of metal toxins. And so we should all basically be putting some nori, which is the stuff that they wrap the sushi rolls in. We should all be getting some nori. You know, you can crumble it up. It can be disguised in a soup. You can crumble it up on your salad. But nori binds heavy metals. And so some of that lead and cadmium that you get exposed to, every time there's a fire, there's more put into the atmosphere and more put back out there on the surface of the land. And unfortunately, certain plants have habits of concentrating things. So you're going to find this really ironic, Gloria, but kale, which we all think is this wonderful, healthy food, mm-hmm. kale concentrates cadmium from soil like nobody's business.
Mm.
And so if you really, my attitude about kale, I'm not a great fan of it, but I'm like, okay, I'll eat it once or twice a week. And my body will be able to handle any cadmium that's along for the ride. But as we put more and more, as we have more and more of these fires, during the immediate time when you're breathing this stuff, that's really the most dangerous thing. Because it's almost like the air is only holding the worst and most dangerous particles, which are the ones that are so small they can stay up there and float around like dust in a sunbeam. And so those particles are the ones that can actually get across the lung and into the bloodstream and get to the brain and get to the liver and the other tissues. So keeping the dust down, HEPA filters in your bedroom, if you can afford that, particularly if you have children, it should be in their bedroom. It just makes a soft humming. But those 8 hours a day that they spend in that room, you can keep the doors and windows closed, and you can actually breathe some clean air. And that's super important. Other things I talked about, and I don't know if it got into the Good Times article because I didn't see it, was about taking your shoes off and having inside the house shoes and outside the house shoes.
Yes, you did mention that. And then there's our pets.
Right.
Too.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, the issue with pets is a lot of people just have indoor pets, but if your pet is going outdoors and they're getting all muddy, you know, you probably want to wipe off their, you know, dry, wet mop the floors more often. When there's fire in the air, and maybe for a month or so afterwards, wet mop the floors more often. But I'm really starting to have a much stronger attitude that I need to, like, decontaminate the floors and keep the dust down and take the dust out of the air, because this has really been a wake-up call for me when I went and looked at even just indoor particulates and the off-gassing from furniture. If you've got an old sofa that's got a fabric cover, every time you plop down on the sofa, flame retardants from the cushions sift up through the fabric and go whoop into the air and remain airborne for several hours. And those things are hormone mimics. They are what are so-called hormone disruptors, and they can give you diabetes. They can these are known to cause precocious puberty. They're known to cause obesity and metabolic syndrome. And we put them out there into the environment. It's too late. That part of it is too late. We can't call them back. So what we have to do is think about how we can minimize our exposure. And one last thing I want to put out to the audience, because it's cheap and it works, is Epsom salts baths. If you take a hot bath with Epsom salt, your sweat will contain lead, mercury, cadmium. You'll sweat it out of your pores.
Great.
So if you do that every couple of days, not only will you feel good, but you'll probably be a little bit calmer, because some of the magnesium does absorb as well, but you'll be detoxifying. So that plus the nori, those are cheap, easy things. Mopping the floor, that's a cheap, easy thing. And these are effectively, in my view, health measures that we now need to just include as part of how we're going to take our self-care going forward.
Okay, two things. So first you said that seaweed binds heavy metals. Does that mean that it grabs onto it and then you expel it through your pores and through your excrement?
Yes.
Okay, another thing, seaweed. What about Fukushima? Isn't our ocean now toxic?
That's a very good question. I am not sure what the radiation levels are, and I honestly am not sure that if there was a problem, they would necessarily tell me. So a couple of years, when Fukushima happened, I actually bought a Geiger counter, and I keep saying I'm going to pull that puppy out and start testing my fish. I guess, thank you, Gloria, for reminding me. I really need to do that.
All right. Thank you for all this information, especially about the Epsom salts bath.
You're welcome.
That's something, like you say, easy to do. And I'll reconsider seaweed, although I don't know.
All righty. Well, you got to try to find a way to eat it. That's all.
Oh, but, well, sure. I'm a cook. I can figure something out.
Cilantro, weeked grass, spirulina. These are also things that are good at binding heavy metals.
All right. Very good clues. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for the call.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we're going now to John in Soquel.
Hi. I called you a year ago. I'm sorry about my bad phone line. I have had MRSA for about a year.
Right. I remember you.
If you can hear me, I have a sore neck that's gradually getting better, but it's very slow. Can you tell me, do you have any suggestions? And I'll hang up and listen, because I know it's a bad phone line.
All right, John, thank you. Okay, so we're going to turn that down because that's got some kind of hum in the background. Neck pain's one of those problems. It's like when someone calls the radio with a rash. You're like, okay, well, it's not the easiest thing to diagnose. But the first thing that one wants to think about with neck pain is, what's the source? Is it coming from muscles? Is it coming from ligaments? Is it coming from bone? Is it coming from disc? And there's some clues that can help you figure that out. In general, the age of the person, you get above 50, then the rate of it coming from bone, that is to say from arthritis, gets higher and higher. And one of the key things that you'll notice with arthritis is that there's a fixed limitation of movement. In other words, if I have a muscle spasm, my neck won't move because it hurts too much and I can't, and the muscle is holding it tight. But if I take a hot shower and I massage it, I can get it to loosen up and I'll get that motion back. On the other hand, with arthritis, if it's because the joint has enlarged, it's like if a door grew and it no longer fit through the door frame, you lose some of the range of motion. You can't get the door through as full of a range on its hinges as you used to be able to do. And that's effectively what happens with the neck. So if those facet joints are arthritic, one of the clues is that your range of motion, usually in chin up and chin down, will be less, and no matter how much heat or massage you do, it doesn't improve. Arthritis needs to be dealt with primarily with anti-inflammatories. Depending on the person's weight, I've been successful a lot using the CBD products, which are the cannabis products that don't cause people to get high. They don't have any pleasure principle attached, so people are more comfortable using them. But they relax muscles, and so they can be helpful for sleep, and they're also helpful for pain. They have innate anti-inflammatory properties, which means they turn off the chemical signals that make you hurt, and that's local effect, so that's very nice. Downside of these is they have a strong odor, and obviously they are medical marijuana. You want to be careful if you travel out of state that you don't take them to a place where they might be considered illegal. Little details like that. And the creams you can get made up at the compounding pharmacies are very useful. So you can get you can basically take ketoprofen, which is like ibuprofen, and mix that with DMSO and mix it with a cream, and have a very, very good penetrating rub for the arthritis and for inflammation in general. And these will also work for the muscle spasms. And they'll work for ligamentous things. One of the other things that I would have asked John if he could have stayed on, was how did the pain start? If the pain comes on gradually, then, or did you wake up with it? Because that's usually muscular or ligamentous. Did it happen after a car accident? You know, things like that. I haven't really talked about discs, but I do want to give you a hint, because if there's a line of pain that runs down your arm like a stripe, that needs to be looked at by a doctor. You do not want to sit on that particular symptom. If you've just got pain in your neck and vague pain in your shoulder or vague pain in your elbow, not so much. But if it's running down your arm like a stripe on a shirt would run down your arm, even if it wraps around like a candy cane, those are things that need to be looked at by an MD and tested, because if you have pressure on a nerve and you do not fix that, the nerve can become permanently damaged, and there's not an easy road back from that. We can do some things with acupuncture, but it's a lot of time and a lot of money, and sometimes even surgery will not be successful if the nerve has been compromised for too long. And we're going to go to our next caller, and that is Sandra in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sandra.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking the call. I wanted to call today to ask you about cholesterol. About 2 years ago, I tested it a total of 218 total cholesterol, and this year I tested it 268. I have high bad cholesterol, but high good, the good one as well. I've always had a very high cholesterol. And so my doctor was not concerned about it because the ratios were favorable.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to be going up. I mean, in 2 years, it went from 218 to 268. And I'm wondering why it's doing that, because I'm mostly a vegetarian. I'm wondering if olive oil is creating that, because I can't quite figure what could be doing that except heredity or olive oil. And mm-hmm. secondly, so I'm wondering what causes that. And secondly, I'm wondering what the next step would be. It's been suggested that I could do a CT scan of the heart to see if the arteries are clogged, but I'm wondering what you would consider to be some of the steps that I would want to look at in addition to that, or if that's the right next step.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. There's a lot there to unpack. So let me start.
Okay.
Let me start with your last question, which was where do I go from here? What do I do for testing?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because high cholesterol is not a disease. And this is one of these things that we have, because there's a drug for it. Everyone thinks it's a disease. No, it's not a disease. It's actually just a risk factor. And and the drugs, when they were originally approved, they were approved for people with rare familial syndromes where they would have a cholesterol of, 350, 400. And this ran in the family. And these people would get early coronary artery disease. And so it was, that's a disease. That's a mutated DNA disease. But having a high cholesterol, and 268 is, respectably high, the first question I have as to the patient is there coronary artery disease right now? And so rather than a CT of the heart, which is going to show calcium, right? If it's the CT I'm thinking, then what they're looking at is coronary calcium. There is a thing called a CT angio, but that's not usually what they're recommending. Now,
mm-hmm.
your calcium score, if it's elevated, that too is a risk factor. But what it's reflecting is the presence not only of plaque, but of calcium deposits in the plaque.
Right.
All right. So if you have a high calcium score, we definitely are more aggressive about trying to modify your cholesterol risk factor and your other risk factors as well. But before we get to the CT scan, there are a couple of blood tests that are super important to look at. And one of them is called high sensitivity C-reactive protein. Do you have any diabetes or prediabetes, or was your blood sugar at all elevated on these recent tests?
I don't have diabetes. I think we did that test, and I think it was somewhat high. I'm looking at the sheet right now, and I can't quite find it, but mm-hmm. not everything is on here.
Yeah.
C-reactive protein that you're talking about?
Yeah, right. C-reactive protein.
Yeah, that
protein.
Was a little on the high side.
Okay.
That was,
All right, so now what you've got is you've got uh-huh. the, think of it this way, you've got the raw material, which is the, mm-hmm. the lipids, and you've got the inflammation. And you could have high lipids. As long as your inflammation is low, those lipids will not get into the plaque. They will not be taken up. But the minute there's inflammation, so an hsCRP of above 3 is mm-hmm. bad. Okay. And mm-hmm. maybe a fluke. It might be the person had a cold the week before, and that'll send it up. So I usually mm-hmm. will get 2 about a month apart. And if they're both high, then I'm worried. Now, one of the things besides a cold or a flu that'll send up your hsCRP is any infection. So you could have like gingivitis or periodontal disease or sinusitis. Those will all kick it up. And
mm-hmm.
and insulin, which is why I asked about the sugar.
Right.
So insulin. Yeah. Insulin is pro-inflammatory. And
mm-hmm.
you're a vegetarian. And there are some vegetarians who become vegetarians. So they eat a lot of pasta, they eat a lot of bread, they eat a lot of whole grains.
Mm-hmm.
What they don't eat is a lot of vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want you to think, has my diet shifted
mm-hmm.
in the last year? So that's one possibility. If you've just kind of drifted into a more bread and starch diet,
mm-hmm.
and that could be part of this change from the 218, which is no big deal, to 268, which is, raising my eyebrow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not both of them, just one, so don't get too worried.
I see. Okay.
All right, so the other test, and this is one that is very good for telling
mm-hmm.
you whether or not you're making plaque,
mm-hmm.
whether you have inflamed plaque, and that's really the question we want to ask, or the question we want to answered. And it's called, you'll want to write this down, phospholipase A2. So phospholipase, capital A, capital 2. Mm-hmm. And this test is available through our own Quest laboratory. It has to be it has to be ordered specifically. But this only goes up in your bloodstream when you are building plaque. So if you are right now here in River City making plaque, that number will be high. And then you know, yeah, I have a problem. And I need to address it. So for the elevated blood sugar, even if it's a little elevated, like say a fasting blood sugar of 102, that means your insulin levels are high. If your blood, and that means you're starting to get insulin resistance, and that's your big problem for coronary artery disease. So you've got to address that. And that in the case of a vegetarian, what that's going to mean is, I'm not worried about your olive oil, but I want your diet to be much more vegetables, and when you do have a grain, it should be like, you know, one third, one quarter the bowl, and the rest of it is vegetables. And that'll help turn around. You should see your blood sugar start to drop. If it doesn't, berberine, which is an herb, 500 milligrams three times a day, that's a good way to improve insulin resistance. Since you're vegetarian, you probably wouldn't want to do fish oil, but you could do flaxseed oil. Some of that will convert into the types of omega-3s that are actually going to help improve your, lower that LDL. So that's something you could do. And I use red yeast rice sometimes. That's a statin-like plant product, or rather it's a fungal product. And that is health food store item. You need to take it with CoQ10. But if you find that you have an elevated PLAC2, if that phospholipase is up, then you're going to want to take some fairly drastic steps and change behaviors, and maybe what you're putting in your mouth, and also your exercise program if you're not as active as you should be. All of these things are going to fold into reducing the risk that you actually develop coronary artery disease.
Right. So in other words, yeah, I hear you, but in terms of the plaque buildup and all of that, I've never really followed that world. It's not like you're not in the surgery or the medicine category. At that point, you can still, even if your arteries are clogged, you could still, if that's the case for me, you could still work with that in your
more
naturally. You don't need to go.
You can, and I want to emphasize that not all plaque is created equal. So there's hard plaque and there's soft plaque, and the plaque that is being built under construction, it makes sense. If something's under construction, it isn't fully formed. That's the stuff that breaks. That's the stuff that breaks, and when the plaque breaks, the platelets dive on that like football players on a football, and they pile up, and they form a clot, and that clot is what gives you your heart attack or your stroke. So the trick is if you have any plaque, most of us by the time we're 60 have some plaque somewhere. If you have any plaque in your coronary arteries, you want that to be the plaque that is having, if anything, cholesterol subtracted from it, not added to it. So that's why getting the inflammation down, that's your fastest, most important thing, is figuring out why that hsCRP is high and attending to it. Because if the hsCRP is normal, then the plaque is not going to add the cholesterol is not going to add into the plaque and make it vulnerable to rupture.
Okay. Sounds like I should probably stop by your office and get you to write up that order to do the blood test.
930 Mission, suite number 5, but please call because I see patients for by appointment only.
Yes, I know. I've been there before. Thank you, Dr. Dawn. I appreciate it.
You have a wonderful day, and thank you. I'm sure
you
helped many people with that question.
Oh, good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
So I want to take a moment and talk about zoster and varicella. because there's a couple of interesting things here. First of all, we started vaccinating kids for chickenpox in 1995, and chickenpox has gone down about 98% over the country. Now, as the number of kids who gets chickenpox gets smaller, the number of adults getting shingles has actually increased by almost 50% in the same period of time. So what's up with that? Well, I think it's a special case of herd immunity. So I think those kids getting chickenpox, which is very, very contagious, you know, people get a little smeared on them, they go out, they touch a doorknob, somebody else moves it off the doorknob to the elevator button, somebody else pushes the elevator button and then coughs into their hand, and now on their hand, they've been exposed to maybe 5 or 6 virus particles of chickenpox. And it's like a little vaccination, like a little booster shot to their immune system that reminds them, oh yeah, chickenpox, I remember having antibodies against that. I think I'll make some. And that's how booster shots work, and that's how having kids with chickenpox in our environment protected us, the adults, from getting shingles, because shingles is chickenpox virus, but it's gone to sleep like Rip Van Winkle in your nervous system, and it's just sitting there asleep. When it tries to wake up, the immune system swats it down if it has enough antibodies and it gets to them in time. Now, just a quick word about antibodies and particularly vaccines. I am seeing a lot of people get very sick from this new Shingrix vaccine. And when I say very sick, I mean swatted, like a flu-like illness, fairly nasty, you know, putting them down for 3-4 days, sometimes real problems with achy joints and arthritis flares in people. So I'm really telling you that this vaccine may be too strong for you. And they made it strong to try to get a good immune response, but I think they may have made it too strong. So people who have an autoimmune tendency, or if they have rheumatoid arthritis or something like that, I'm really encouraging you to get the old shingles vaccine, which doesn't cause as strong an immune response. And you do have to be careful because that was a live virus vaccine, so you might yourself become slightly contagious. You don't want to do this if you've got a newborn grandchild. But I'm recommending the old shingles vaccine rather than this new hot Shingrix vaccine, which is being promoted so avidly that you won't be able to walk into a pharmacy without hearing all about it. But if you have an autoimmune tendency or you have an inflammatory disease, I would think twice before getting the shot, and I'm certainly going to give it a miss. We're going to squeeze in one last quick caller, and that's Marcia in Los Gatos. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Dr. Dawn. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a person that has the stripe down my arm, and it's just so frustrating and painful. I sleep on my back so that the C5 can, you know, expand. We can expand the vertebra. But I'm wondering if you know of a good surgeon if one did have to go to surgery to correct this.
Well, I really, that's basically neurosurgery, and there's many fine neurosurgeons in Los Gatos and in the San Jose area, but I don't really have a specific name I can give you. Just off the top of my head, I don't. What I would suggest that you do is ask friends and family this time if your people are talking to each other, and see if you can find out if anybody's had you'd be looking probably at a laminectomy surgery here. But don't go to surgery first, okay?
No.
I want you to go to physical therapy and look into something called home cervical traction. I don't know your specific, whether it's applicable or appropriate for you, but I have had great success with unloading the nerve by just having people put their neck in a little bit of traction so that they're stretching it. And if you get relief lying on your back, it seems to me like you might be a good candidate for that. You do have to have a helper to do it safely. It is tricky, but I would strongly recommend giving that a shot.
Thank you so much. And if you do have time in this last bit to talk about fibromyalgia, I would appreciate it.
All right. Well, we do have time, just a couple of minutes. But fibromyalgia is a very interesting entity because it is almost a sleep disorder, if you will. If a person has a fracture or they have a whiplash or something like that, and it interferes with their sleep for a couple of weeks, they'll often start to develop fibromyalgia, which has a definition. You can go look it up and look at the map. There's a lovely map of the three graces with their hot fibromyalgia points. But people who have this condition have an abnormally strong pain response. And so places that would ordinarily, don't push any harder on that, the person with fibromyalgia will practically jump out of their skin when you push on that spot. They'll often have symptoms of also where things that shouldn't hurt. Like, for example, putting a heavy jacket on, and so the weight of the jacket is pushing on your shoulder, and yet that will be causing that person pain. And when we do brain studies like functional MRI, we see that the pain centers of the brain in people with fibromyalgia are turned up, they're revved up. So part of what we have to do here is we have to get the sleep fix. That is absolutely critical. And we have to get the person to go into deep sleep, which is when your body becomes completely paralyzed and the muscles are relaxed. And it's that deep sleep that is going to be the key to stepping back from fibromyalgia. Trigger point injections, which were pioneered by a woman named Travell back in the 1950s. She did this manual called a trigger point manual. She discovered you could just inject a little salt water or even nothing into these points and that it would unhook the fibromyalgia. But the interesting thing about this is that if you look at that and you look at an acupuncture map, she had pretty much independently rediscovered acupuncture as a Western doctor who had, in the 1950s, who'd heard nothing about acupuncture then, no one did, but she rediscovered that these points, when they were needled, would provide relief. So I always send fibromyalgia patients to an acupuncturist and have them go through a series of treatments. I'm particularly fond of something called Craig Pens. That's Dr. Craig, Craig, and then capital Pens. You should look into getting a series of those treatments. I don't know if you want to make the journey over to Santa Cruz, but if you go to the American Academy of Medical Acupuncture and put in your zip code, you'll get a list of certified MDs, and you can simply reach out to their office and find out if they do this Craig Pens procedure. It is great for radiculopathy, and I have, I'd say, a 75% success rate with improving people's symptoms, and that's the technique. That's not anything special about how I'm doing the technique. It's a good technique, and it works well. I'm afraid we're out of time.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn. Have a wonderful season.
Goodbye, and have a great day.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.